Next case for argument is 15-1091 MCM Portfolio v. Hewlett-Packard.
May it please the Court. Edward Heller, representing MCM Portfolio, LLC. The first matter I'd like to bring to this Court's attention is something new that we just realized that we have to bring to the Court's attention. Because this case involves the Article III constitutional jurisdiction of the Board to actually render a decision on the merits or any other decision, under controlling Supreme Court authority and under this Court's case law, the constitutional issue must be decided first as a conditioned precedent for this Court to actually consider and decide any other issue in this case.
What constitutional issue? The jury trial issue?
No, it's a matter of constitutional jurisdiction under Article III.
Well, you didn't raise that issue in your brief, did you?
No, but this is a new issue that I frankly admit it's a new issue, but I'd like to bring it to the Court's attention. In a Supreme Court case, the Steel Company versus Citizens for a Better Environment and this Court's own holding in Meinson Company versus McHugh.
Is this something you is just newly discovered? It's not based on anything that has occurred in the legal scheme?
No, it's just something that I realized recently. It's my fault for not bringing it to this Court's attention earlier, but it's a requirement of the Supreme Court, and it's a requirement of this Court's jurisprudence. So it's like a standing issue. It's something you can't waive. So moving on to, do you have any questions on this? Or is it?
I'm not sure what you're talking about. That
okay.
That Meinson case you're talking about, isn't that the CDA case?
It's not really a patent case, but it has to do with standing, okay? And
you're relying on it for the theory that this is jurisdictional. We have to decide it even though you didn't raise it.
Well, we did raise the whole point of the constitutional argument that there is no constitutional.
But you didn't raise the Article III issue. You just admitted that.
Oh, no, this particular aspect of the Article III issue. The whole point of the constitutional issue is the Article III issue.
What aspect of Meinson are you relying on?
Well, it's the fact that the Court must first find that that there is constitutional jurisdiction if that issue is raised. And
constitutional jurisdiction where? Here?
No, for the Board, for the
Here
Director.
Your argument is a violation of Article III. To put the validity issue before the Board. You didn't raise that issue in your brief, but you say it's jurisdictional and we have to address it anyway, correct?
We did raise the constitutional issue.
Yeah?
We raised the constitutional issue.
You raised the jury trial issue.
The jury trial issue is part of the Article III issue. The Article III issue is our main avenue of...
I'm trying to help you clarify what you're arguing and you're resisting it.
Okay.
I don't understand why.
The Article III issue is whether the Board has the constitutional authority to decide an IPR and whether issues like revocation of patents has to be tried in an Article III court as a matter.
You didn't raise that issue before, but you're saying we have to address it anyway because it's jurisdictional.
Yeah. Did raise it before. What I'm trying to say now is that it's a little bit different aspect is that you have to decide this issue, the Article III issue, which we did present, first before you can decide other issues. That's the only nuance.
What is the issue that you raised at the beginning of your argument, which you said you didn't raise in your brief?
Oh, it's the precedent. precedent, that you have to do this one first.
Let me see if I get it. Is all you're saying is we can't decide this based just upon the board's obviousness findings. We actually have to rule on the constitutional error.
That's exactly correct.
Okay.
That's all I'm saying. Now, turning to the constitutional issue, the board did not actually decide that issue. They just decided they were bound by this court's decisions in Patlex and Joint Technologies.
But isn't this panel bound by those decisions as well?
That's my next point. This court has the power under Troy v. Samson to decide a prior panel decision is overruled by subsequent controlling authority. And I would like to then turn to what I believe is subsequent controlling authority. First, I'd like to talk about this court's holding in Lockwood. Lockwood was a holding of this court that patent validity declaratory judgment actions had a right to a trial by a jury.
Is Lockwood an en banc case?
That's a good point. It's not.
Well, then how could it possibly overturn prior precedent? Isn't the rule that the earliest precedent is binding, even if subsequent precedent is inconsistent?
Yes, and it was vacated after the Supreme Court took certiorari when it was mooted. But this court has consistently followed Lockwood in subsequent decisions, including the most recent case of technology licensing. But it's not en banc, I agree. But if Patlex controls and Lockwood is not, then there is no right to a jury trial for patent validity. Three judges of this court in arguing for en banc in Lockwood argued that very point, that if there is a right to a jury trial for validity, that necessarily overrules Patlex, because the administrative revocation of a patent is inconsistent for invalidity. It's inconsistent with the right of the patent owner to have a jury trial in that issue.
Suppose we were told that there's no jury trial right in an Article III court on an invalidity issue. Just hypothetically, would there be anything wrong with giving that issue to the PTO?
Yes. You know, that's the next case I want to talk about. This is the recent Supreme Court case of Stern v. Marshall, decided in 2011, which, among other things, reaffirmed that the prior authority that came out of Murray's Lessee, consistently held in Crowell v. Benson, Northern Pipeline, Grand Renitiera, and Stern v. Marshall, reaffirmed that any case that was actually litigated in the courts, common law courts, that includes the courts, the common law courts, the courts of equity, or admiralty at common law, are inherently Article III type cases and cannot be removed by Congress and given to an administrative tribunal for a decision. So the question then becomes, is an IPR, which actually revokes a patent for invalidity, is that like any action that actually took place at common law? Because if it is under Stern v. Marshall, then that cannot be removed by Congress from the courts to the Patent Office. And it turns out that the common law did have a right to revoke a patent for invalidity, and that action was known as the action scire facias. The action was filed in the common law side of the Chancery. It had a right to a jury trial. It is a legal action. The Supreme Court in Maury versus Whitney discussed the actions under writ scire facias, identified three grounds for repeal of a patent, a revocation of patent, double patenting, fraud, and invalidity. The recent article by Lemley thoroughly discussed the Scary Fossey has actions filed in the law side of Chancery, right to a jury trial. John Paxton Norman treatise we gave you says the same thing. And I'd like to bring this court's attention to the Supreme Court case of Ex Parte Wood and Brundage, where the Supreme Court held that in actions, statutory actions, to revoke a patent for invalidity, there was a right to a jury trial. That was a holding. And why? Because the right to revoke a patent for invalidity was like the common law writ, scire facias. That was the holding of the court. And they cited in that case, the Supreme Court cited in that case, Seventh Amendment. So part of the basis of that holding of the Supreme Court was the Seventh Amendment. So, reiterating, under Stern, if a case was actually litigated at common law, type of case, it must continue to be litigated in the courts. It cannot be reassigned to administrative tribunal by Congress. That would be a constitutional violation of the structure of our government under Article 3. And I think it's clear that an IPR, which invalidates, revokes in whole or in part as a result of invalidity, unpatentability if you want to call it, but invalidity is what the government calls it, is exactly like the writ scire facias at common law. And it has a right to a jury trial, and under Stern v. Marshall, it must be tried in an Article 3 court. I would like to reserve the balance of my time in case the court wants to talk about anything else. Thank you.
On behalf of Hewlett-Packard, may it please the court. HP is sharing its time with the government, and we have divided up some of the issues. But there's 3 points I'd like to address today. First is something that Consul Brentium didn't address, and that's the obviousness decision of the board. The issue here is whether it was supported by substantial evidence, and it is. Second is the privity issue and whether HP's petition for an IPR was barred under Section 315B. Was it a time bar? The issue here, there are several sub-issues. One, is this issue even appealable? If it is appealable, then on the merits, was it correct? And is it subject to mandamus? And third, the third question is the constitutionality of the IPR statute. So turning first to the obviousness issue.
Well, why don't you focus a little more on the constitutionality question since that's how you're starting?
On the constitutionality question, the government is going to take the lead on that issue. We are aligned with the government as far as Hewlett-Packard's position. We think it's fully addressed in the brief. We think IPRs are similar to reexaminations, and the issues that have been raised by MCM were decided by this court in the Patlix case and in the Joy Technology case in the context of reexaminations, and those decisions apply equally to IPRs. And MCM has not shown...
Is IPR different at all from reexamination?
Yes, it is different. It's not identical, but the same policy reasons behind the IPR, behind reexaminations, and looking at public rights and patents and the government issuing patents, and the government, by Congress, has the authority to correct mistakes in patents that are issued. Those are all the same reasonings that apply to IPR, and that's why it's our view that the Patlix and Joy Technology decisions are binding and controlling on IPRs.
You may not know the answer to this question, but at common law in 1787, was there a procedure in the patent office in Great Britain that allowed for something like reexamination?
I don't know the answer to that. Perhaps my government counsel knows that.
Since they're laughing, they probably know.
Yes, we divided up the issues to conserve the time allotted. If the panel does not have questions on the obviousness issue, I can go through it quickly, or I can address the privity issue. Because to some extent, the obviousness issue is unique to HP, and so are aspects of the privity determination or the decision under Section 315B.
Well, let me ask you about the privity issue, because why isn't, I mean, we've got two cases out now. One is Quozo, one is Versada, and they reach a somewhat different conclusion based on whether or not we're talking about a CDM or not.
Right.
So why does this case, when we're dealing with the 1 year and the privity issue, not fall on the same line as Quozo did with respect to CDMs, and therefore allow for review with, in connection with the final decision?
HP's view is that the time bar decision under 315B is not appealable under Quozo. It's the same, it's a patentability decision. It is not, I'm sorry, it's not a patentability decision, and patentability decisions are appealable as part of the appeal right of the final decision from the board.
But in Versada, we said the question of whether or not this is a CBM is a matter that's reviewable on appeal, because it's kind of sort of like a jurisdictional question, kind of sort of a threshold issue. And why doesn't the time bar privity issue fall underneath that umbrella?
Well, this is an issue that the government is also going to address, but for HP, we see the issue of the time bar as more akin to the issue in Quozo and not the CBM issue in Versada. The sections of the statute for the inter parties review, Section 314 in the appeal, or the no appeal of the institution decision, is written very broadly. And it's written broad enough to cover the time bar decision under Section 315B. And we think that the court's reasoning in Quozo applies to this issue. And the other issue that's been raised is whether the time bar issue is appealable or reviewable via a mandamus route. That decision's already been decided in this particular case, because MCM filed a petition for mandamus on this issue when the board instituted the IPR. And there's nothing here, nothing since then, that MCM has shown that establishes that it has the right to mandamus. There's no evidence that the board acted outside its authority and met the strict standard for mandamus. Counsel for MCM raised the case of the Minison Company case versus McHugh, and that case allows this court not to reach the appealability of the 315 time bar, but rather to go and look at the merits of the privity issue and decide it on the merits of what the board found. And the board found, with regard to privity, that MCM had not shown sufficient evidence to show that HP and Penn Digital were in privity together, such that an IPR would be barred. If the panel has any questions about the merits of the privity decision, I'm happy to address that. Otherwise, I could turn over the podium to
government. Why don't we do that, and we'll allot your remaining time to the government.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Will Haffman on behalf of the Director of PTO. The director intervened to address two issues of institutional importance to PTO implicated by this appeal. If I may turn first to the question briefly of reviewability in response to Chief Judge Prost's question as to the bearing of Versada on this case. As the court is probably aware, the government believes that Versada was incorrectly decided with respect to the question of reviewability, and we have petitioned this court for a hearing on bank of that question. But even under the logic of Versada, Versada plainly does not apply in this case. And that's because, A, Versada took care to note that that was a case dealing with covered business method patents rather than with IPR, whereas Quozo was a case about IPR. Second, that was a case, as Chief Judge Prost noted, about whether or not the question of whether a patent was, in fact, a covered business method patent was somehow a question that bared on the board's final written decision. And the court in Versada made clear that it was that this was an appeal from the board's final written decision and that an appeal from the institution decision would be barred under the logic of Quozo. And this court, in the St. Jude case, and more recently in the GTNX case, has made clear that the question whether a petition is time-barred under Section 315B is a question that goes only to institution as opposed to the final written decision. St. Jude was a case in which the board declined to institute inter partes review under 315B, and the petitioner in that case appealed to this court and argued that that was made many of the same arguments that MCM makes here, and this court rejected that argument, and it made clear that the time bar of Section 315B bears on the institution question, and that's plain from the text of 315B itself, which says that an inter partes review, quote, may not be instituted if it is filed more than a year after the petitioner or someone in privity with the petitioner was sued for patent infringement. So even under the logic of Versada, this case is governed by Quozo. And if there are no further questions, I'll proceed to the constitutional question. My colleague from MCM made a number of arguments with respect to the constitutional question. First, this court has already decided this issue in Palex and in Joy Technologies. This court
has decided about re-exam.
That's right, Your Honor.
Is re-exam the same as IPR?
It's not the same, but it's the same for purposes of the Article III analysis.
And how so?
Well, as this court framed it in the Patlex case, the question is whether or not PTO, under the authority assigned to it by Congress, properly granted the patent in the first instance. And that's the exact same question that is at issue with respect to inter partes review. That is, whether or not the PTO, acting under its constitutional authority, was right to grant the patent in the first instance. And the fact that there are different procedures attendant to an IPR rather than to an ex parte reexamination does not make a difference. And I don't actually understand MCM to be making an argument that those different procedures make a difference. Rather, MCM argues that that Patlex was sub silentio overruled by some of this court's subsequent precedents and from Stern, but nothing could be further from the case. Stern, in fact, strongly supports the government's position with respect to the Article III question here.
How is that right? I mean, how can a patent right be exclusively a public right under Stern if it involves the liability of one individual to another?
Well,
your view must be if Stern does, that this comes within the public right articulated.
That's right. The government believes that a patent is a quintessential public right that may be adjudicated by a non-Article III court or administrative agency. And that's because, as the Stern court itself put it, although the claim in Stern was deemed to be adjudicated in an Article III court, that was a claim that derived solely from common law. It was a state law claim for tortious interference that did not originate from any statutory scheme and that was not governed by an expert government agency. And the court in Stern made clear that if the claim derives from a federal regulatory scheme, or if resolution of the claim by an expert government agency is deemed essential to a limited regulatory objective within that agency's authority, then that is a public right. And here, a patent is solely a creature of statute. It is.
Yeah, but, I mean, Stern, it's not all that clear. And we have a very odd situation here in which invalidity questions are adjudicated both in the courts and before the PTO, and the argument is based on the cases following Lockwood that
there's a jury trial right with respect to the invalidity issue when it's adjudicated in an Article III court, but that it's okay to remove the issue entirely from the Article III court and put it into the administrative agency. That is not a situation, so far as I know, that has come up before in the public rights context, so it is a little different. And I think, for example, if we had a situation in which the district court were statutorily authorized to refer the invalidity issue in the context of an infringement suit for adjudication of the agency, there'd be a real question as to whether that was permissible, right?
I don't know, Your Honor. I think that your question raised a number of points. First, Congress did not take away from Article III courts jurisdiction to hear invalidity claims. It provided parties with an alternative, less expensive, less time-consuming process for determining the question, the very same question that was at issue in Patlex and Joy Technologies, and that is whether the Patent Office was correct in the first instance to issue the patent. And under the Supreme Court's public rights doctrine, a patent plainly falls under the ambit of a public right, whichever way the court characterizes it. A patent is a creature of statute. It is overseen by an expert government agency tasked by Congress with administering the patent scheme. And as the Supreme Court has emphasized, a patent is, by its very nature, is affected with a public interest, and that's because it's a monopoly that operates against the public at large. Judge Sykes, you were referring earlier to the Seventh Amendment question, but I think that it's important to note that the Seventh Amendment and Article III present two distinct inquiries. In the first question, when Congress decides to send a right into an administrative agency for adjudication, the first question, the only relevant question, is whether or not that right is a public right that Congress may authorize to be adjudicated in a non-Article III court. Now, if Congress decides to send a statutory right into a federal court, that raises the Seventh Amendment question. And the Supreme Court has decided a number of cases, including the Curtis v. Lothar case and the Purnell case from the 70s, in which the court was dealing with a statutory scheme that Congress sent to be adjudicated in Article III courts. And the Supreme Court found that a jury right attached in those cases, but in both cases made clear that nothing would have prevented Congress from sending those statutory rights to be adjudicated in a non-Article III forum in the first instance. So even if this court thinks that a jury trial right attaches in the validity case, and even if this court believes that that validity and the inter partes review processes implicate the same kinds of questions, that is not dispositive. That simply does not bear on the question whether Congress may send a right to be adjudicated in an agency in the first instance. And there's no support for the contention, which is raised by amicus, that somehow the different procedures attendant to inter partes review and ex parte reexamination can distinguish those cases. The Supreme Court, and no court to my knowledge, has ever suggested that different procedures in an administrative process bear on the question of whether or not Congress may designate a right for adjudication in an administrative scheme. And as we note in our brief, it would be a very peculiar rule of constitutional law if that were the rule, because as far as I understand the argument, it means that the more process parties have in an administrative process, the less constitutional that process would be, and that simply can't be correct. I see that I'm well over my time. If the court has any further questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Thank you.
I would like to first address the issue of whether a patent, because it's statutorily granted by Congress, gives Congress plenary power over that newly created statutory right, making it a public right because it's a public interest or whatever theory the government has. That automatically makes it a public right.
I mean, there's no question that Congress can allocate to an administrative agency the power to determine whether patents should be granted in the first place.
We agree with that because that's consistent.
And to rule on the validity question as part of that initial examination, right?
No question.
So why can't it essentially provide
provide for reconsideration of that issue and place the reconsideration issue in the administrative agency which granted the patent in the first place?
Because the Supreme Court has been consistent on this issue. Once the patent or any right granted by the agency under the law has passed from the agency, it has no authority to reconsider the validity of that action. The validity of that action is exclusively a matter for the courts. The first Supreme Court case to actually decide this issue is Marbury versus Madison. That was the exact issue before the court in the Supreme Court on the mandamus petition there. They decided that the government had no authority to revoke the appointments. There's a change of presidency. The new president wanted to revoke the appointments of the prior president. The Supreme Court said no. The validity of the appointments was exclusively a matter for the courts. So this is not a new issue. This is an old issue. The Supreme Court has been consistent that if a right has issued from an agency, from the government, there's a property right in that, and the only institution that can revoke that right is an Article III court. Now, of course, if the patent is a public right, there's a consequence. If a patent is a public right, there is no right to a trial in an Article III court at all. There's no right of anybody to say, I have an Article III jurisdictional right. Because public rights and Article III jurisdictional rights are inconsistent. They're mutually exclusive. Similarly, there's no right to a jury trial with a public right. Because jury trials are only stem to things that actually were legal actions in common law. And if it's a legal action in common law, the court has consistently ruled that they must be trialed in an Article III court. Therefore, there's no right to a jury trial if a patent is a public right. I would like to bring this court's attention that copyrights, trademarks, and patents are all granted by statute. The Supreme Court has held in three different cases recently that each of these rights has a right to a trial by jury in actions in court. Dairy Queen cited that trademark rights have a right to a trial by jury in court. Feltner decided that copyrights have a right to a trial by jury in court. Markman decided that patents have a right to a trial by jury in court. Three Supreme Court cases. They are all going to be overruled if somehow, just by merely granting the government granting the right, having the power to grant the right, makes it a public right. All those cases are not properly decided. They're all overruled. The Supreme Court going to overrule all those cases? I doubt it. I severely doubt it. There's something inconsistent with the government's argument and Patlex with controlling Supreme Court authority, and it's quite clear. I'd like to briefly turn to the merits argument and bring this court's attention to A220 in the appendix. Could you please turn to that page, A220 in the appendix? It's a diagram. This diagram was not in their petition. This diagram was in HP's reply brief. This is the sole evidence and argument that Kikuchi teaches that Kobayashi could be reconstructed into a controller chip. We objected in our oral argument that was an improper argument made for the first time in the reply brief. We cited the rule 42.23.
Sort of the same way that you're raising the merits without having addressed it in your opening argument.
We did raise it in our briefs. So, we did raise it. And of this pointing it out here again, that's when we were saying that argument was not presented in the petition, and there was no evidence in the petition, I'm showing you that where the board's idea of reconstructing Kobayashi came from. It came from the HP reply brief. We objected below, and we objected here. We renew that objection. That's not proper evidence. It's not proper argument. Briefly on the 315B issue, I'd like to refer this court attention to the GTNX case, which held, where the board had held, that this, the may not institute language is jurisdictional. That's, if it's jurisdictional, and if we believe it is jurisdictional, it's always appealable under Supreme Court case law. I would like to refer to, specifically refer to Hinkler, the Hinkler case, which said that denials of institutions are generally not appealable, but when an agency does institute the jurisdiction of that agency to the jurisdiction of that agency is always appealable. So there's no question that if the shall not institute language is jurisdictional and is always appealable in our mandamus, the government argued that the 315B issue could be raised on appeal. That was their that was the basic argument they had made to this court for the reason to deny the petition. This court said that we had the opportunity to raise the petition on appeal. So they denied the mandamus without prejudice to our raising it on appeal. Based upon the argument of the government that we could. Now, the government, when they said that at the time, they must have believed that there was a reasonable construction that you could raise the 315B issue on appeal. There was nothing that nothing in the statutory framework construction that it was inconsistent with that argument at that time.
Now, in our order denying the mandamus, we didn't say, what did our order say?
It said, we deny it without prejudice to MCM being attempting to raise the issue on his appeal from the final written decision. So, this court believed that we could. The argument of the government in denying the mandamus is that we could. We did. And now they say that we have, now they change their position and says no. But the counter to that is, it's jurisdictional. And because it's jurisdictional, it must be appealable under Supreme Court case law. Is there any further questions?
No. Thank you. We thank our counsel and the case is submitted. That concludes our proceedings.
All rise. The Honorable Court is adjourned from day to day.